We are pleased to inform you that you have a place at Potterversity.
Studies podcast. On today's episode, we are going to boldly go where no Potter podcast has gone before. Welcome to Potterversity. On today's episode, we are going to explore strange new worlds, seek out new connections, new consistent themes, and boldly go where no Potter podcast has gone before. I am Katie McDaniel, Professor of History at Marietta College in Marietta, Ohio, co-editor of Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Emily Strand of Potterversity, Essays Exploring the World of Harry Potter.
And I am Emily Strand, Director of Campus Ministry at Ohio Dominican University, contributor to Harry Potter for Nerds 2, and co-editor with Katie of Potterversity, the book.
Today, alongside our wonderful Potterversity producer, Lori Beckoff, Emily and I are taking on the new planet of Star Trek Harry Potter analysis. There has been some of this, but we think we're going to take it in some new, exciting directions. Yes. Welcome, Lori, back to this side of the microphone.
Always a pleasure.
We're so glad to have you here. And I'll just say, this was definitely, you were sort of like, we have to do a Trek podcast.
Yes, I'm taking credit slash blame for this, because every time we do an episode together, we end up talking about Star Trek. It's happened several times now that it felt like there's something happening here. And we realized we all like Star Trek. We should talk about this. And it's not done that much as a crossover.
Yeah, right. It's very interesting. I think part of it may be, we'll talk a little bit about that later. I guess I have a theory. Well, before we get into our Star Trek Harry Potter mashup, we need to talk about this great book review that we had in Mythlore, where we had a joint book review with Lana Whited's book, The Ivory Tower, Harry Potter and Beyond, and the Potterversity book. And it was a good review.
It was very thorough and very intelligent discussion of kind of the state of Potter studies. Yes, and so the review was by Liam Butchart, and he it was really very thorough, and he is a podcast listener, and we got to meet him at Chestnut Hill Harry Potter conference last year. So it was really great. So thanks a lot to Liam and to the folks at Mythlore for that great review.
Yeah, and I really liked how he was thinking about it in terms of, you know, what these anthologies have to say about the field, which is, you know, when you have an anthology, it's kind of setting some parameters for the field. And he drew some interesting distinctions between what we were doing in the two different volumes. And I think it's really cool. So I hope that our listeners will check that out.
Yes, Mythlore's content is all available online.
It's all there for free.
Yeah, right. So you can log in there. It's an open access journal. So it's full of wonderful, wonderful articles too.
Yes. And if our listeners haven't discovered Mythlore, you will like this journal.
And we can link to it in our show notes.
Yeah.
There's also an article in this issue about Harry Potter and Beowulf, and specifically Goblet of Fire and its parallels with Beowulf. I happen to be cited on the first page of that article.
Yay. Love it.
Yeah. Right.
And rightly
listeners,
so.
We bring you the top people, right? So that's pretty cool.
Just ask us.
Yes. So let's just dive right in to talking about Star Trek. So let me ask each of you, how did you get into Star Trek and what's your favorite series? Lori, let's start with you.
So my parents are both Trekkers, not Trekkies, they will say. So I grew up on reruns of Next Generation, as well as a couple of classic episodes, a couple of classic movies. I'd seen Wrath of Khan, but I didn't really get into it until grad school when Discovery was starting, and it like started a conversation, me and a new friend. He had just started watching all of TNG in order and said, "Oh, do you want to do that while we also watch this new show?" So that became our tradition all through my time at grad school of watching both Discovery and TNG. When I finished grad school, came back to my parents, I watched the rest of TNG, and then the pandemic happened and they said, "Do you want to watch Deep Space Nine? We haven't watched it in years." So we watched all of Deep Space Nine and all of Voyager and all of Enterprise, and then watched almost all of the new series. We weren't that into Lower Decks, but the rest we keep up with. And there is a channel that shows all of Star Trek every night. It's called Heroes and Icons. It's like a random cable channel that shows an episode of each Star Trek like 6 nights a week. So now I am just the type of person who watches Star Trek multiple nights a week because it happens to be on. And I now feel like I'm on a constant cycle of Star Trek. And I named my dog Moogie after Quark and Rom's mother on Deep Space Nine. So I've
Boogie.
gotten pretty deep into it in the last 5 years.
Right. Yeah. Gosh, there's a lot of Star Trek content. There's a lot of series to, get interested in Star Trek. Emily, what about you? What was your access point to the world of Star Trek?
Well, when I was a kid, I remember watching the original series after school, or sometimes it was on kind of later at night. And I used to remember, sitting there with a snack and watching these episodes. The Trouble with Tribbles was off and on, so that was kind of a favorite. And enjoying those, that in the Twilight Zone also, very, very good companions there. But then I didn't really, I think listeners know now, I'm kind of late to the party with speculative fiction in general. So when I was slated to help edit a scholarly collection on Star Trek, I decided that that was a good time to get really deep into Star Trek. So I took Amy Sturgis's course for Signum University. On Star Trek, I just audited it, I think. And I got kind of, I love when Amy brings me into a franchise. Amy is great with her courses at laying it all out and giving you the origins and the kind of narrative, both diegetically and also, in the real world. And so I got my very professional introduction to Star Trek and just tore off through the different series. She gave us like 5 or 6 episodes of each series
Yeah, I
to
was gonna say
watch.
she's really good at figuring out which are the episodes you really need to see.
Curating. She kind of curates them. And it's not like those are the only important episodes, obviously, but they're the ones that really generate a lot of interest and discussion and maybe work well kind of standing on their own, which, as we know, many Star Trek episodes do work well. As standalone episodes. And so stuff like The Measure of a Man and Encounter at Farpoint, the classics, The Cage. We watched the trailer, The Cage. So I really felt like I came at it from a great point of view, thanks to Amy Sturgis. But I've burned through all of, I think I still have a few of the original animated series to watch. Those are a little kind of weird. So those I've saved some to watch. So, but I think I've watched everything else now in the last 4 years, probably. And I would say my favorite would be Voyager.
Voyager.
I love me
Well,
some Voyager.
I don't know. Did Amy steer you in that direction? She loves Voyager as
Possibly.
well.
I feel
Yeah.
like
Yeah.
that's
You
an
know what I love about,
unpopular
I
fave.
know it
Not that it's
is
unpopular, but people think it's like,
uncommon.
yeah, it's like
Yeah.
TNG light. Like
Oh,
TNG is
see.
my favorite, followed by Deep Space Nine.
Yeah, and I love both of those. Like, I love all of it. I love Lower Decks. I love, it cracks me up. I love the new shows. I love the old shows. I just love to love it. But the reason I think I like Voyager so much is because, A, I'm a serious Seven of Nine fangirl. Janeway and Seven of Nine, really. I'm team both. But I love the way that it has like a really distinct like narrative arc. Like TNG is like so kind of character based and everything, and the way that it kind of concludes, it's not
And
exactly,
episodic. episodic.
Yeah, it's very episodic, and it's kind of about this Picard arc and the different characters and their arcs. And but Voyager's like, they have a goal. They're trying to get home from the Delta Quadrant. Like, and the story ends when they get home, you know. I mean,
yeah, it's a little
alert,
Gilligan's Island. That was for it where is. I was like,
every your favorite
episode,
is in Deep Space Nine
home.
Then. Like, you want to talk about arc. Like, to me, TNG I love because I think so many of the individual episodes are so good, and Data is my favorite character ever.
Yeah, yeah.
But then Deep Space Nine I love so much because that really has a lot of continuing arcs, and the character development through that series is amazing. So even though I've never been crazy about all the Emissary stuff, it's like I find it so compelling in the way the characters grow and the way their relationships change.
I do too.
And
I
Julian Bashir, I love him.
Yeah, he is great. I mean, like I said,
and the recurring characters too that keep coming back, like Kai Winn and Dukat.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
and she drives
Keiko
me nuts,
and Cassidy.
Though.
But Emily, I was going to say, like, Deep Space Nine is the one that takes religion the most seriously, I think, you know, in terms of religion and politics, don't you think?
I think that's why I don't like it sometimes. And I would think you would be into that, Emily, all the religious politics.
Yeah, I am totally into it. Guys, I'm into all the Star Trek.
Yeah, you like them all.
Me pick a favorite.
You made me pick a favorite.
So I'm going to pick Voyager just because it's like every episode I'm like, is this the episode where they get home? Is this the episode? And then I just love the way it happens.
Do you know it's 7 seasons long? To me, it's actually the opposite sometimes of, well, I know this isn't going to work because I know there are 7 seasons in this show.
You know what? It takes all kinds. But my son has gotten now into Voyager. Like you watch Prodigy. So the animated series Prodigy, he has watched that, and that really did exactly what the franchise was aiming at. It totally made a new Star Trek fan. And because it plays with characters from Voyager, characters from a few shows, but especially Voyager with Janeway and Chakotay. And so he got really curious about Janeway and Chakotay and like the whole Voyager situation. And so he was bored one day and he said, oh, there's nothing to watch. I don't have any shows. And I was like, well, why don't you watch Voyager? He's like, okay. So now every day. And Lori, it's so funny that you say you're one of those people who watches Star Trek like multiple times a week. Hi, every night.
That was me
the past 4 years.
Like all of those series for months on end, I watched nothing but Star Trek. And then I found all the reruns on this other channel. So it's still like, oh, if I don't have a specific thing I'm sitting down to watch, or I'm just like, you know, getting my stuff ready for work the next day, I'm like, what's on Star Trek?
Yeah.
There's always a Star Trek. Yeah. So I have a similar story, I guess, to Emily, in that it was the original series when I was a kid that was showing in reruns. And then I watched The Next Generation, but it came on Saturdays or something. There was some time when I was, you know, I remember watching it on the tiny TV in my parents' kitchen.
And, yeah, same.
And just very digestible stories, right? And it's a full thing. I like the fact that it didn't have an arc right at the time. But I guess I've just continued to like it. I don't know. I think I haven't watched all the series. Sometimes they get a little involved and I can't stay with them. So I think that was with Discovery. And was that the most recent one?
Yeah,
it was a lot. And like, I missed an episode and I was like, I have no idea what's happening now. So I couldn't get back into it, but I do. I like the world. I actually just referenced it in my world history class. I was talking about technocrats, which is a phenomenon of the 50s and 60s in both the United States and the Soviet Union, Cold War era, the idea that technology can solve the world's problems, be they, you know, political, economic, social. And I think Gene Roddenberry is a classic technocrat. And so I said, for those of you who know Star Trek, maybe one of you does, right? That's technocracy. How many times does Geordi's visor save the day?
Mm-hmm.
How many
or data, times? Just data
yeah, or data. Right. So, so I think it's so culturally important as well. Great stories, great characters that obviously have animated a lot of people, a huge fandom there. So I don't know, Lori, if we got your favorite series though.
Oh, I think I said it's TNG, but DS9 is a close second.
Okay. All right. I find Deep Space Nine the most analyzable, I guess, but in terms of what, like if there were multiple of the series that were on, like which one would I watch? It'd probably be Next Generation. Maybe for nostalgia, but I really like Picard. I enjoy Chakotay also, but I just like that. I like his, there's something, I don't know, there's some deeply human quality that I gravitate to there. So
now when you say you like Picard, do you mean the character or the show?
You know what? I didn't watch the show because you had to buy a streaming service. Am I right? And like, how many?
Which don't get me started on how it feels to have a show that's set in a post scarcity, you know, post poverty, post capitalist society, be on a premium streaming service. But I'll leave it at that. To be on PBS, right. I don't mind having bad effects. I think that campy effects are part of the charm of science fiction.
I agree with that. That's the Doctor Who reboot was very, you know.
Well, now it's on Disney and now it's expensive. I'm fine with it being campy.
Right. Yeah. Right. But we're not there yet, right? We're not post scarcity. We're not post, you know. But anyway, okay. So these are some themes that we might talk about. But okay, why are we talking about Star Trek on a Harry Potter podcast?
Because it keeps coming up.
You know, Harry Potter is often compared to Star Wars, but not so much to Star Trek. I don't know, you know, we could talk a little bit about why that is, but also like, and why do we think maybe it's time for that?
I would kind of start by just pointing out the big differences between Star Wars and Star Trek. In that, you know, Star Wars is really a mythic story. And it really relies on notions of transcendence and human connection to transcendence. And it, you know, it's much more kind of classically based on the hero's journey and deals with, you know, kind of human mortality and coming to understand and accept our mortality as humans and what we can do in the face of ultimate evil, right? Like what, you know, and Star Trek has some of those elements, right? Obviously, but it's such a, like Katie, like you were saying about Gene Roddenberry, it's this technocratic story. It's this story about what can humans be? What can we achieve if we're just at our very best? You know, how can, and that's why I love, I just gave a presentation at work with my colleague about the nature of like prophetic preaching and like what elements go into like preaching that is really prophetic. So I work for a Dominican university, so we're all about the preaching. And so we talked about, my colleague said, you know, prophetic preaching really like creates a vision, an alternate vision of the future. And that was my cue to talk about Star Trek, you know, so, which I like to take those cues. So I talked about the fact that, it kind of lets you envision this future where humans do these amazing things as a matter of course, because that's what we've sort of progressed to because we've been at our very best. You know, we've striven for literally the stars, and, you know, we get to envision people working on these tablets, which of course now is the reality that we have. And so I think that Star Trek has this very humanistic core that doesn't lend itself as much to comparisons with Harry Potter, because Harry Potter is also that mythic, you know, story that really wrestles with human mortality in the face of transcendence. And
I was thinking with what you said, that was sort of what I was thinking about before that I stopped myself from saying that, you know, there's some way that, you know, it's long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away. So there's a deep rootedness in the past. And I think you definitely get that with Harry Potter as well, right? That you've got the past is so important. It wells up. It's not, you know, it's not as ancient a past as the Star Wars series, but it's got that kind of roots. But the Star Trek series is very future oriented.
Oh yes.
It's based on kind of enlightenment notion of, you know, we're achieving progress and we're on this, you know, this positive arc in human development that is very tied into our understanding of science and human agency and the ability to use our rational, you know, talents, our ingenuity to develop machines and, you know, all kinds of technologies that will in fact make us better in the future. But I wonder the degree to which like Star Trek also kind of undercuts that, because like things are solved on Earth. So human beings being what we are, we can't just sit and enjoy utopia. We got to go out and find trouble on other planets. And so in a way, I think it is, even amid all of that, progress and success, it is still seeing that these very human problems and the desire for transcendence, all of that is still there, but that persists even with the achievements of modernity. What do you think about this, Laurie?
I totally agree with that point, Katie, that I do feel in a way that, yes, they seem quite different. Star Wars is almost more science fantasy. It's got, people with some magic powers that can't really be explained, as opposed to most of the stuff happening on Star Trek has some kind of scientific explanation given to it. So I think that's why we see more of that sense of fantasy in Star Wars and Harry Potter, not so much with Star Trek. Also, the whole chosen one thing versus this is just a group of people with jobs. But what you touch on about, a futuristic society where things should be better but have their own problems, I think that's sort of what the Wizarding World is for Harry too, right? That like, oh, he escapes, and the fantasy it is for the Muggles reading it of, oh, well, maybe within our own world there is hidden a magic world that's better. But in that world, look at all the problems they have between violence and corruption and prejudice. And I think that click something for me on all these episodes of Star Trek where, oh, not only are there problems out in the rest of the galaxy, even if we've solved a lot of problems on Earth, there are often conspiracies within Starfleet. There are all these
Right.
issues where someone is just following orders, but Starfleet's doing maybe not the right thing here. And do the people on this ship have to decide whether or not they think that's an okay order to follow? And I think that some of the issues of utopia not being a utopia are encountered in both of these series. And another thing I think is distinct is the episodic nature that we were talking about versus Harry Potter and Star Wars being more of, at least in the original Star Wars films, a saga with a specific storyline of defeating the big evil. And that's not so much the case in Star Trek, where there are all these other little issues every episode where they meet different people and go to different planets. But especially in Deep Space Nine, which I would argue is the most Harry Potter-like, partially because of the arc, there definitely is a sense of, fighting a battle against evil, but also at the same time within, because Deep Space Nine also brings in a lot of these problems with Section 31 and what, the Federation is willing to do and what things are the Ministry willing to do. That's also not what we thought would be the case in a wonderful, magical, or advanced society like this.
Yeah, I love those ideas. And just thinking about the politics of both, right? The idea that you can have an advanced and powerful society that has an ideology behind it that can become really toxic and that can actually make you kind of transform into something that's the opposite of what you were supposed to be. And I think we can see that in the Wizarding World and, with the Federation in some regards too.
Yeah, the new shows seem to really want to play on a lot of that, the kind of inversion of Starfleet into something less than what, the noble, or institution that it has been in the past. And sometimes I get a little frustrated with that. Sometimes I just want Starfleet to be really good.
Yeah,
Like, I
no, I
just want to be
know. I
a
think.
reliably, noble, but it's good probably for me to be challenged out of that. But I think that's also kind of popular in storytelling right now, is to have the kind of
Ambivalence.
darker narrative.
One of my favorite things on Star Trek is when we have a group of people who we all are presented as decent, well-meaning people who disagree about how to go about something. I think that's one of the most powerful things about Star Trek is not just having these are the good guys, these are the bad guys, but here's our ensemble of the crew, all of whom we know are decent people, but they have different approaches to a situation. Like there's a season one episode of TNG. I know TNG is not generally considered great in season one, but there's an episode called Symbiosis, where they discover that this planet, these two planets that one is supplying medicine to the other. It turns out it's a narcotic and the people on the other planet are all addicted to it. And Dr. Crusher and Captain Picard have this whole back and forth about, well, should we step in? Is that not the right thing to do because we should not, decide for other planets and get involved in their affairs? Or will it make it worse if we try to step in versus if we allow them to fix it themselves? And Crusher says, well, if we don't step in, there will be more suffering. And I always want to reduce suffering. And Picard says, well, we have to think about the bigger picture. And I love those episodes that get at the idea of there's not necessarily one good and one bad. there's we are people trying to work together who are all trying to do the right thing and might have just disagreements about how to approach it.
Yeah, and I actually thought you were maybe going to point to the fact that sometimes the people on the planets that they encounter are doing wrong things or like things that were like, oh, that's bad. But then when you understand them better, you understand why they're doing it, right? Like the people who move really fast in the original series. I'm thinking of original series ones, you know, and so they'll tag a person and then bring them into the super fast world. They sound like bees buzzing. Is this, I don't know the names of episodes.
I don't recall this particular episode, but I'm not as familiar with original series.
Okay.
Yeah, so I'm due for hopefully
a listener out there knows what I'm talking about. But and then you kind of figure out that they're doing it because they're trying to survive. This is kind of their way of survival. Or how about the one where these two societies are at war, and to take the brutality and the immediate like graphic violence out of the war, they just kind of randomly pick a certain number of people to die, and they have to go because, oh, you're now a casualty, so now you got to go die. And I mean, I think it raises these interesting questions that maybe don't have so obvious answers, as people sort of say, oh, like, is that a good idea? Or how about the one where this is the next generation, where when you reach a certain age, you go in for euthanasia.
They do like ritual suicide.
Yeah.
God walks on.
Yeah. Right. Right. And it brings up all these questions that are related to cultural relativism and absolutes, and makes you think a lot about them. And I think that there's some way in which, you know, it's teaching you to try to understand cultures and societies that are different from your own, and to be able to put yourself in other people's shoes. And I definitely think that that's something the Harry Potter stories are doing also with some of the other creatures. I don't necessarily think it does it maybe all that well all the time, but I definitely think that's a goal of the series, is to make you like think about the house elves. Obviously.
It is. Yeah, it is. And I think it was more of a central goal for what Gene Roddenberry was doing. And I think for Harry Potter, it more kind of happens along the way, you know, rather than being kind of a central goal of the whole storytelling project. But I just also wanted to give a shout out to say David Ogden Steers was in that episode, euthanasia one. And I was like, why would I know this guy? Like, oh, he's so familiar. Why is he so? And I don't know actors and stuff like that. Like, I don't know their names.
I forgot, but then that was him.
I looked him up, Michelle, and I was Forbes. Like, it was the clock in Beauty and the Beast.
Oh, the clock. Michelle clock. Forbes is the daughter on that episode who later comes on as Ensign Roe.
Yeah, you're totally right. That's so funny how Star Trek, if you've watched everything and you're like rewatching it, then you like just randomly see.
You just see
people.
Jeffrey Combs everywhere. They're like, yeah, it's nonstop like, Jeffrey Combs and James Cromwell.
It is. It's so funny because they're like trying them out, you know? Even Tom
Paris.
You
see
character.
Like Ethan Phillips, like a lot of people who are on late. Ethan Phillips was on earlier as a Ferengi. Well,
as
Ferengi actually,
yeah.
I'm now going to try to bring like three threads together about cultural relativism and Ferengi and house elves. And how each of these series, you know, approach race and species, because I think that Harry Potter gets a lot of flack for, you know, not having good portrayals of other magical species, for
and
goblins.
Especially goblins. Yeah.
Yeah. For goblins potentially being anti-Semitic, for house elves for being happy slaves, sometimes even for centaurs. And I think that Star Trek is considered so progressive in how it talks about race. And I'd like to discuss this, because I know that we've talked before on the show about how some of the readings of other species in Harry Potter seem reductive and don't account for cultural relativism. That it's saying, oh, house elves are happy slaves, that's a bad thing, there shouldn't have been slavery in the books, when there are lots of different ways to read them and lots of ways to consider their own cultural values and how they've just been taken advantage of based on that. And same for goblins. I know Beatrice Groves has done readings on this and how goblin society is maybe just different from human society. But people do not seem to mind as much the way that Star Trek sometimes has uncomfortable implications.
Like the Ferengis are kind of goblin-like.
Yeah, they are.
Okay, we're going to talk about the Ferengi, because every major Ferengi is played by a Jew. I'm just saying.
Wow.
Every single one.
Wow.
Aaron Eisenberg, Armin Shimerman, Max Gradenchik, all Jewish. All
that is interesting.
Typically, quote unquote, like nebbishy, short Jewish men. I'm just saying.
Yeah, no, that is a fair point.
They are a money grubbing species.
Yeah,
who
they're
learn though
max capitalists. I mean,
yeah,
they're just
but they're really like an you know what humans used to be like, and that's what they're meant to be a representation of. Like you know,
yeah,
us
I
and
thought
our
they were
worst
the British.
impulses.
I thought they were the British with all their finance. Like, but, I mean, that's the center of finance. Like, I'm an 18th century British historian. So I was just like, the Ferengi are obviously British. But I think that way about the goblins, too, that they're kind of old Britain, you know?
And in a way, Ferengis are quite goblin-like. But yet I don't see people criticizing Ferengi in the same way. And I think part of it is, I mean, the Ferengi, we see these characters all develop in different ways. We see Rom literally become a communist and lead a communist revolution. He quotes Marx in his union building. I love that episode, season 4, Bar Association, one of my absolute favorites. We see their mother, Ishka, known as Moogie, the inspiration for my dog's name, who like leads basically a feminist revolution.
Feminist revolt, yeah.
So there, and we see someone like Rom who decides also that like, oh, you know, maybe finance isn't for him, and for Nog, oh, he wants to do something different. But I mean, how different is that from Dobby wanting to be different from the other house elves, or that, you know, Ferengi have their own society that can grow and change, and maybe goblins can too. And I also think Klingons are another one to bring up, that there are a lot of episodes that treat Klingons as though they are like biologically, instinctively violent and aggressive. I was just watching the Deep Space Nine episode where Worf is like on trial for potentially committing a crime that they're saying was like motivated by like Klingon bloodlust. And there's an episode of Voyager where B'Elanna gets split into her Klingon halves, which the first time I watched that, I was like, that seems really messed up to imply that like a mixed race person has
two different essences
based on that. So I'm not saying we should throw out Star Trek either. I'm just saying if we're willing to consider all these different angles on Star Trek, I think that Harry Potter does have a certain amount of nuance we can look at there too.
So although I was thinking too, we don't see anybody really becoming friends with goblins in Harry Potter. In
the
same way that
with Grip Hook is not great.
They're a part of Deep Space Nine in a way that they do form friendships, and we get to know them as individuals, and we don't
Nog
so
and,
much.
Avery Brooks's son, what was his name again?
Jake.
Their friendship is really sweet.
Right. And we don't really get that close a view of the goblins. They're always kind of outside. And that's posed as a problem within the society, that the two don't mix well and that there's a lot of hostility, animosity that prevents those kinds of friendships and maybe mutual understanding. But maybe, you know, we can see that as a potential opportunity, that the text doesn't really present that possibility. It doesn't present the actual friendships, but this is something that people could maybe imagine from that, because they are treated, I think they're treated with some respect for their different views. I think so. The goblins.
Well, this is also where we get into amount of content. You know, Star Trek,
right?
A lot of the stuff was more aggressive on original series, with Klingons especially. And then on TNG, they were like, well, let's have a Klingon be one of our main characters, and he's going to be like really cool and different and nuanced and have, you know, 7 seasons and then 4 more on Deep Space Nine to develop. And we don't necessarily have the same space for that with Harry Potter.
Right. Yeah, I was thinking that too when you were talking about the episodic nature. We were talking about episodic nature of, you know, some of the Star Trek series. I wonder, and I know you don't want the TV show, Lori, but I wonder if the TV show Harry Potter will be able to like mirror some of the feeling of episodes, with the sense of having the episode feel complete and not just part of an arc. Like, are they going to be able to pull out moments so that they seem like they have their own internal story as a part of a TV series? I'm curious about that.
Don't hold your breath.
Like,
okay.
I'm just thinking about, like, would a goblin ever go to Hogwarts? You know, I mean, no, right? Because they're not allowed wands.
But a Ferengi goes to Starfleet Academy.
It says that was the very point I was making. Because you guys are both so right about this, because I mean, there is obviously Star Trek does have more space to explore these things, but like the tension is there. You know, Ferengi are people have, you know, and sometimes rightly so, these ideas about Ferengi, you know, and having to watch being scammed by them and having your money taken by them, things like that. And their aggressive capitalism, you know. But Star Trek definitely takes the time to explore those and question and poke at those, right? Whereas with Harry Potter, it's, you know, it's kind of only done when it's needed kind of for a plot device.
Mm-hmm. And it's there for the fans are the ones doing it a lot of the times.
Yeah.
Right.
Which is why I do think that it's good for fans to look at things in different ways and explore how it could be different rather than write it off as this should never have been in the series. It's inappropriate. We've had this before with, was it Christine Schott, I believe, who we had on?
Right.
Talking about the house elf problem, and that, well, it raises questions, even if the questions are never answered in the books, mm-hmm. there is, you know, value to the fans discussing and thinking about that in creative and complex ways.
Can I just say one more thing about the Ferengi? Maybe the goblins are based on the Ferengi. I mean, I don't know, you know, like.
Well, I mean, yeah. There's always been the talk of like goblins are clearly based on like much folklore and it's not like a direct.
Right, exactly.
From human culture.
I know.
Direct from many things, but could Ferengi have been Ferengi, one of the inspirations?
I don't know,
when were Ferengi first introduced? Like season one of TNG, right? So.
Yeah, I think, maybe not season one, but
I
definitely
think it is season one. But they're really different. Right. They start as like being kind of villainous, but they're ridiculous. And then they were like, let's make them funny. Actually, let's make them nuanced. Mm-hmm. So they really did. That's the other thing. It really did improve and change. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. And Armin Shimerman said that one of his goals in Deep Space Nine was to redeem the Ferengi, you know, and he does. He goes a long way toward doing that. By the way, the actors who played Tom Paris and Harry Kim have a podcast called The Delta Flyer. They have Armin on the show sometimes, too. And those are great. They have great discussions.
That's fun.
Highly recommended.
Awesome. Yeah. So I wanted to go back, Lori, to a comment that you made offhand, but that we should follow up on, which is that you think Deep Space Nine is probably the most like Harry Potter in terms of the way that it's laid out. And I wondered if you could tell us a little more about that.
So I think number one is Chosen One. That's the first Star Trek that we get like, oh, the captain is not just the captain. He is the Chosen One, which I honestly didn't love that much starting Deep Space Nine because to me, I was like, that's not how Star Trek works. We're all a team here on this, you know, thing in space.
And is that Sisko? So Sisko's the Chosen One?
Yes. Sisko is the emissary of the prophets.
Mm-hmm.
And that's something he has to carry with him throughout the series that sometimes has benefits, but a lot of time he feels very awkward about and puts a lot of pressure on him. So I think there's a certain Harry Potterness to it, and it even goes back to like his origins and how he was conceived. So there's that whole like tracking back the family history.
Yeah, that got weird.
Yeah, it did get weird. I have a lot of feelings about that you're not all that positive. I do not like where some of that went. I think the prophets are the villains. That's a story. That's a talk for another day. But I think the prophets are the bad guys. Actually, speaking of bad guys, another big connection I see is that I think Kai Winn, the character played by Louise Fletcher, is
genius,
so
character.
Incredibly Umbridge.
Yes.
That is such Umbridge energy because we have like the real bad guys being the Cardassians and the Dominion, and Bajor are supposedly allies. But Kai Winn, as the head of the Bajoran religion and then also government, has this sickly sweet demeanor. She always says, my child, to people, especially Major Kira.
Awful.
And she seems like, oh, we all want the same thing here and we're all on the same side. And I just, every time I'm like, Umbridge energy.
Yeah. And what she wants is ultimate power.
Yeah. She wants for herself. She's like, oh, I'm so against, you know, the Cardassians and the Dominion and all that. But it's always really about her.
So, but I'm showing that I have not watched Deep Space Nine in a long time, but doesn't she get some kind of arc as well in her development?
Oh, yeah.
It's not a good arc, though.
No, it's not. Things don't go well for her.
Yeah, but I mean, is it Umbridge-like, though? Or is it different?
Her motivation is definitely portrayed as, like she has a crisis of faith at times, that she is someone who does really believe in the prophets and is always seeking them for guidance. And she is... I do think ultimately she's out for herself, but she is motivated by something larger than herself that she just thinks she is the best representative of, and then, you know, has all that kind of fall apart. And in a way, it's like, you know, I guess you could compare it to the way Umbridge thinks, at least initially. She's upholding order. She's upholding the ministry. She's doing what she must in order to, you know, run a society that can not go into chaos. But
right. And if you think about it in terms of the, you know, the ministry and the threats that are out there and what's defined as a threat, and then also the power of ideology. I mean, I think definitely Umbridge is ideological in a way that is guiding her behavior, and that's Kai Wen to a significant degree too.
Oh, Kai Wen's also definitely behind the bombing of that of the school that Keiko had set up, which is very like Umbridge sent the Dementors after Harry.
Yeah, she is so rigid in her views that she ends up serving the other side. Also, I mean, I don't want to prevent any more slamming of Kai Wen because I'm here to do that all day. But also this notion of the death of Sisko's wife, Jake's mom, it really hovers over the story in a similar way to the death of Harry's parents. And it's definitely something that you never get away from in the story, and it's constantly altering or coloring the narrative. And I think that's a similarity.
Cool. Well, let's see. Are there other similarities that we think we would want to draw out between the Harry Potter series and various Star Trek series?
Well, another one I picked up, and I did a paper a few years ago for Chestnut Hill at the Harry Potter Academic Conference about peeves. And I think
Yes.
Q is something of a peeves figure. He, for one
Yes.
thing, seems to be a wizard. He has indeterminate power that he can basically do whatever, whenever, however, as part of the Q continuum. He's kind of a wizard, but he's also very much a trickster. He comes
Trickster,
in and
yeah.
messes things up all the time, but like ultimately ends up helping sometimes, and he's kind of testing humanity. And Picard is always like, oh my God, get this guy away from me. But then it's so fun to watch. So I think there's a little bit of peevesness
Yeah.
in the way that
And
peeves
he's
can
doing it
sometimes help to
for his
give our
own
hell from
inner
us peeves.
yeah, but he's doing it for his own entertainment for sure,
He is.
right? Just to kind of like play around with people and
He's a
manipulate
bored
them.
god. That's what,
Yeah,
or that's
right.
what Q is anyway, is a bored
Q,
god.
yeah, Peeves is, lesser, right? But we do sometimes see Q taken to task, right? So there are people that Q is afraid of as well. Maybe not afraid, but constrained by at least.
He can't always get his way. I mean, he really wants to have a baby with Janeway.
I was only thinking about
Really,
TNG. I forgot about that.
really wants
And then he
Janeway to be
does
the
make
mother
his
of
mini
his.
Q.
I know.
Well, and then
Not
they have a
her,
whole
though.
thing on Picard about him.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. What a great character. I always see him at GalaxyCon. So in Columbus, we have this big nerd convention, GalaxyCon. Katie's been with me. And I always see John DeLancey in his booth chatting with people. He's never like one with like a huge line or anything, but he's always like there animatedly
Why
chatting
not?
with somebody. I know.
That's
I'm always
cool.
like, oh my God, it's cute.
So, I guess also they both play around with some of the similar kind of motifs or like devices, like time travel is one. And then I was thinking about mirror universes and like I think Harry Potter plays with mirrors and mirrored characters as well as the mirrored worlds of Muggle and
Oh,
Wizard.
yes.
I think Harry sees himself in possibly Voldemort's story. Like, is Voldemort just evil universe Harry in the same way, right, that we see in the original Star Trek? With those, I mean, I was just sort of playing around, just throwing out those. And then also the way that they play with time travel. I don't know if that's just because time travel is fun to write or
Well, I
what, but.
mean, they both do have questions about time travel. I mean, you had your whole paper from Chestnut Hill about the hippogriff that
Right.
like and the quantum mechanics surrounding time travel in Harry
Yeah.
Potter. So I think they both, when they get into time travel, have those questions of can you ever actually change anything? If you changed it, was it always that way? I think City on the Edge of Forever, original series, is one of the major ones that plays with time travel.
Yeah, and it helps you to think about, I mean, I think time travel as a literary technique, it helps you to think about agency and the degree to which people have control over what's happening and how do you exercise that. And also I think it imagines this thing that we don't have, like what if we had it, which is foresight. Like if we could tell what were going to be the consequences of our actions, would that change what we are able to do? There's that next generation one with this constant loop and they keep making the same decisions over and Right. And so they never get out of the loop. So I think it's kind of, I think it's kind of a way to play around with some of these questions of, you know, what can we even do as human beings? And certainly in the Harry Potter series, it's kind of teaching agency to Harry in an important way, I think, in book three, particularly.
Katie, I would also think as a history professor, you know, I'd love to hear your take on how they both play with the idea of history in general, because so much of Star Trek is based in like the horrible things that happened in the 21st century before they got to that point. Episodes like Past Tense with the Bell Riots, which would have happened just this past year, canonically. And then not just the time travel, because the time turner can only take you back, you know, a few hours in Harry Potter, but all the things we look at in the Pensieve, all the talks about the First Wizarding War, about how Voldemort came to be, about Grindelwald as well, and how history casts a shadow or has lessons or is part of where we are now.
And I think that they're really beautifully continuing that kind of tradition of inquiring into those sorts of things in Strange New Worlds, with what we know eventually happens to Pike, you know, and his kind of awareness of that on some level. And then also there was an episode where this person who had been played a pivotal role in some kind of, you know, genocidal events in previously, and then now he's like a peace activist and like playing back and forth with the past and the present and what is the reality? You know, what is the reality? So I think I love that they're continuing that that tradition in Trek.
Yeah, and I mean, I think there's a real question, like for the historian's craft, which I'm always interested in, of like, if you know how the story ends, does that change how you tell the story, right? Are you always going to tell the story so that it comes to that end? And, you know, and so again, that's kind of playing with that idea, like if I knew how this was going to end, like how would that change the way I did it? And also historians talk about teleology, which is the idea that when you're telling a history, you often sort of imagine that there's a straight arc between the past and what you've ended up with in the present. And that can actually be quite deceptive, right? And that it encourages you to leave out a lot of the things that as variables could actually have changed that trajectory. So I think that's really interesting. I also was going to say, this is not exactly what your question was asking, Lori, but I think that both Harry Potter and the Star Trek series are deeply invested in 20th century politics and are really very much about the key challenges of the 20th century ideological battles that were raging over you know, questions like race, nationalism, but also the profoundly important ideologies of liberalism, that is democracy, and communism and fascism, and sort of really engaged with, you know, some of the fallout of that in it, the way that Star Trek imagines like we've gotten beyond that, but then we can put those battles. I always think about the, you know, the original series. The original series comes on after Svengoolie on MeTV in where I am. And we always watch Svengoolie on Saturday nights for B quality horror movies, The Blob or whatever. And so I've watched the original series a little bit more closely. But anyway, so the one that's imagining like that there's this planet where they obviously just had the American Cold War nuclear apocalypse, where you got the Yanks and I can't remember the other group's name, the Comms or something, but it's obviously the Americans and the Soviets who bombed themselves out, and now they just have the lingering vestiges of their society. And it's asking us to think about the, you know, the consequences of 20th century politics. And I definitely think in this century we're still playing out all of those things as well, and trying to get a grip on, you know, that by imagining it in a different place. And, you know, I was just, you know, when you read back through the Harry Potter series, you know, it's not like that those political tensions have become irrelevant. So I think about Timothy Snyder's address at the Harry Potter Academic Conference, where he was talking about the importance of book five, I think particularly about the rise of totalitarianism in governments and everything. And, you know, people getting seized off the streets and, you know, being pronounced illegal. I definitely think that these are things that are we're still playing them out, and that these are imaginative texts that are helping us to think about ourselves and like, what would we do in a certain situation?
I agree with all of that. The ministry interfering at Hogwarts. It's like, we're living that.
You're also making me think about prison and the justice system are very present in both of these. We have, there are multiple famous episodes of Star Trek with hearings. You know, my favorite being The Measure of a Man on TNG, but there are several on DS9 as well. There are
and
a couple
the original.
On Voyager. I think all of them have a few of these.
Yeah.
And original series, of course. I mean, the whole menagerie is actually like about whether Spock should get in trouble for bringing Pike back to Talos IV. So I think the justice system is major here. We also see hearings in Harry Potter with the Wizengamot and his hearing at the ministry, as well as with the Muggleborn Registration Commission. And this is such a theme in a lot of Star Trek on all these different planets they go to, where it's such a thing that like they go when someone accidentally breaks a law they didn't know existed, like Wesley getting sentenced to death for, you know, stepping on the grass. Or B'Elanna getting arrested for having violent thoughts.
Oh my gosh. And that one killed me.
And so I think this is, I think it ties in with the idea of the fascism and everything of what these various ideas of justice and penal systems are like throughout the Federation and outside of it.
Yeah. And think about how in Star Trek, a lot of it is, you know, the modernism and the technologies that are helping to, in fact, constrain people's freedom and to invade, you know, like to be able to know what you're thinking and punish you for it. And in Harry Potter, it's magic. And that those are really corollaries for each other in the same way.
It's Arthur C. Clarke, right? Is it Arthur C.
Right.
Clarke? Any sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic?
Yeah.
You nailed it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think that that's an interesting connection between the two as well. So one of the things that I think, Laurie, you had suggested before was if we look at some of the characters, there's like maybe an interesting connection to draw between Dobby and Data. And I was thinking about it, especially in line with some of the ideological battles and like real like power struggles in both series. How do you see Dobby and Data as being connected, Laurie?
I'm going to say one thing and then throw it to Emily, because Emily has that whole essay about Dobby the robot, which I think is relevant. I was just thinking of them as characters who are different from the other people around them. We have Data as an android, Dobby as a house elf, but he's also very different from other house elves. And they both have a noble sacrifice. Spoilers for Star Trek Nemesis, that my favorite character ever, sacrifices himself. He's back in Picard. It's fine.
He got old, but, you know.
But we have these characters who are, you know, not the same as the, you know, humans that we see around, who make like the most noble sacrifice for their friends. And I think it was in Beth Sutton Ramsbeck's book that she discussed that as much as people say, oh, you know, the house elves are so ridiculous, that Dobby is treated as so noble on the level of Lily Potter, on the level of Dumbledore, as like a major hero self-sacrificing character in a series that treats self-sacrifice as an incredibly noble and esteemed thing to do. So it gives him a level of quote unquote humanity. And same for Data, who always, you know, wishes he could be human and says he does not feel, which is a lie. Every time Data's like, oh, but I do not feel. You do feel. You just use different words. You do. Don't tell me you don't. How can you say Geordi's your friend if you don't feel friendship toward him just because you spend a lot of time around him? Data feels, okay? So that's generally what I was just thinking about them as self-sacrificial, non-human characters who show a deep level of humanity. But I'd love to hear, Emily, your take, because you've written about Dobby specifically as similar to artificial intelligence.
Right, right. Well, they're both created servants. I mean, that's this trope of the being that is created by humans to serve humans, and then what is the human responsibility toward them? It's a wonderful device for exploring very complicated issues. And I do think that Data's desire to be more human is very much akin to Dobby's desire for freedom, and I love thinking about the two of them. I think, there's another connection in the sense that Dobby's kind of like pat on the head sort of character, but and he's a liability sometimes. Obviously, he's getting Harry in trouble and things like that in book two. But there is a deep house elf magic that is not to be underestimated, only to be underestimated by the foolish. Like Voldemort. Sorry, again, another way in which Voldemort's not always a great villain. But Data is also his kind of, like, I want to even call it superiority to humans. Is it's an ironic superiority because he doesn't see it as superior because he can't feel. And I don't want to get into a fight with Laurie. I definitely won't do that. Maybe he can feel, but he obviously can't feel in the same way the humans feel, so, or he wouldn't want to so bad, So, and then of course things go bad when he can, things go poorly when he does gain that and he has to, turn that switch off or something. I don't know how all that works. But so it's definitely this kind of this ironic superiority because he doesn't feel superior, but he's always, like we said earlier, he's always being relied on to solve the problem in the same way Spock is often relied on in the original series to solve the problem because his Vulcan physiology, his mixed race, human and Vulcan physiology gives us like a superior, again, a very dynamic he can he doesn't a noxious gas will not affect him in the same way, and he's just kind of like superior to humans in many ways, and so I think Data has the same kind of quality to him. But again, to him it's ironic because he doesn't feel superior because he wishes he could feel and wishes he could have the full human experience. But
Well, now you're also making me think of Measure of a Man again. Well, in addition to the feeling, that being like Dobby, that they both, want what is not supposed to even be able to be wanted by their. Yeah, if he can't feel, how can he want? And Dobby's like not supposed to want freedom. But Measure of a Man is making me think again about the whole conversation that Picard has with Guinan, where if they want to create more Datas, which is what Bruce Maddox's goal is, that then it becomes a race. And to do what? To serve. So one Data is an oddity, a peculiarity, but a whole race of Datas, like what do we call that then? Like it's creating a slave race. And we've had talks before about how did house elves become enslaved? Were they, just helpful little spirits, as it's like based on brownies and folklore that people started then taking advantage of? And that so makes me think then about that connection of if that trial did not go in Data's favor, and if a whole race of Datas could be made, would that then be what we have with house elf slavery? Not, oh, a helpful being here and there, but a whole race of slaves. And that's a connection I hadn't actually put together, that specific conversation that's so powerful from A Measure of a Man about having more becomes a race and becomes a slave race.
And well, and in Picard, they play with this because the fear is that these beings in numbers would take over the world, and we would be, enslaved to them.
Yeah, that's like the AI fear.
Yeah, exactly. So it's interesting how that's kind of developed. Now that we're so close, we have AI. This is like part of our reality now. We're not sure what kind of form it's going to take. We do have these anxieties that are played out in these stories with created servants, and that's akin to like the very first work of modern science fiction that dealt with the created servant or robot trope was RUR by
Carl Chapek.
Chapek. So that is they were also synthetics. So they were not robots. They were not metallic robots. They were synthetics like Data. And it was an interesting, and the idea was that they would develop a consciousness and take over the world, and we would be, subservient to them. And so that was the fear. But yeah, it's I think it's an absolutely fascinating trope. And if I could just plug that paper that Laurie referred to is called Dobby the Robot. And it was published in Mythlore, the journal we spoke of earlier in 2019. So that should be available online. You can go to my academia.edu page where I link it in my profile. So.
Yeah, so I was going to say on this topic, one of the things that I think about is the, I mean, I'm just going to go back. I guess I said this with the goblins and the Ferengi too. I'm going to go back to friendship because I do think that is a key theme of both Star Trek and the Harry Potter series, the value of friendship and like a deep moral value. It always sounds kind of corny and shallow, like friends, but actually it's the deepest, most important value that exists. And especially when you're thinking about systems of unfreedom, enslavement, the idea of like, how does Data become human? How does Dobby reach that? And it's through their friendships, and self-sacrifice is in a way the deepest expression of your friendship for other people and your willingness to put yourself on the line. And I think it's Tocqueville who says that the dictator does not care if you love him. He just doesn't want you to love each other. And to me, that's such a profound statement about the power of friendship when you are facing, you know, unfreedom. And that is what it's equalizing. It puts us all together in this, you know, human situation that we're in.
Oh my gosh, I just got an image of Luna's mural on her wall that says friends.
It's so powerful. It's such a powerful idea. Like, and it's what we have. Like, this is what we have as human beings, is our interconnections, our friendships. And when these series are exploring that with other, whether it's the house elves or the goblins, or not exploring it with the goblins, or whether, you know, you're looking at it with, you know, mechanical life, then I think it's sort of, they're exploring similar issues.
Okay, quit it. I'm going to cry.
Aw.
Yeah, you had to get, you brought it to like a really, really beautiful point, because that's what I get so emotional about. I said on like Deep Space Nine, the growing relationships, like watching Bashir and O'Brien sometimes, I'm like, oh my God, look at them. I love them. They're going to the holodeck together. And like, it gets me. And I do think, and I say too, with like Data and Geordi's friendship every time, I'm like, how could you say he doesn't feel? He loves Geordi so much. Mm-hmm, he was willing to give up his emotionship because he was afraid he could hurt Geordi. Mm-hmm.
And so often the friendships that when we see them, that they mean the most are the ones that are crossing some kind of boundary. You know, when it is, you know, it's bringing together people who are supposed to not care for each other. I mean, and I know, again, that Cursed Child is not everybody's favorite, but I think that was supposed to be the core idea in the Cursed Child, that
was the best part.
A Slytherin and a Gryffindor together.
We were having such a nice conversation.
But no, you're right. That is absolutely the most compelling part of that story. I would almost say it's the only compelling part of that story, is the friendship between those two, between Scorpius and Albus.
Well, now we're leading into, not to then get it somewhere else, because friendship is great. We love friendship. But you are also pointing to relationships that are sometimes thought of as queer, which has been a hallmark of both fandoms. Some of the like first slash fan fiction was Kirk and Spock.
Oh, absolutely.
And now you're talking Albus and Scorpius, which is very often seen to be as a queer relationship. Remus and Sirius, Wolfstar, major, major in Harry Potter fan fiction. So also, of course, turns to these relationships are so strong throughout both of these series that it draws people to imagine them in even stronger, in different types of ways.
Eroticize them. Mm-hmm. Yes. Mm-hmm. Which just brings a different level of intensity. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right. But it still shows something about the strength of these relationships, I think.
Yes, absolutely. And I mean, I think that the part of the eroticism of it comes from the willingness to care for and sacrifice for each other in a kind of interesting dynamic, and that fans want to explore. So you bring up the fandoms and how fans are taking these ideas. And I wonder if you have thoughts, because you two are, you know, you're fans, especially of Harry Potter, but also of Star Trek. And, you know, what do we see as some of the, you know, some of the characteristics of these fandoms, and do the fans themselves overlap?
You know, that's a really interesting question. Everything I say will be completely anecdotal, because I don't really do fan studies, you know, myself. I will say I find Trek fans to be a very smart lot. They are intelligent people who love to wrestle with big concepts, and I really appreciate that about Trek fans. It was a very interesting experience editing scholarly volumes on Star Wars and on Star Trek at the same time, because there was a gigantic difference in the way that those went and the kind of timeliness of submissions and things like that. Like, the Trek people are very buttoned up, and I really appreciated that about the Trek people. Shout out to our Trek contributors. But I've never really thought about the character of Harry Potter fans and how it relates to Star Trek. I don't know why I haven't thought about that. Somebody think about that for me and help me form my opinion.
I think that Harry Potter got so mainstream, probably beyond. I don't know if you, I mean, would you say it's correct to say that Harry Potter got more mainstream than Star Trek?
Duh, I think so.
Maybe. I
I
feel
think
like
it.
even like in my office, if I bring up Harry Potter, like everyone knows what I'm talking about. If I make a Star Trek reference, people know, like, I know who Spock is, but they
Right,
don't necessarily, or
yeah.
like, oh,
I
I've
think it.
seen like one or two of the movies. Maybe they saw the J.J. Abrams movies.
Yeah, I think Harry Potter does appeal more broadly, maybe not as broadly as Star Wars, but I think Harry Potter does appeal more broadly than Trek, which is part of why Trek fandom, I mean, I'm sure people say things, and are crazy in Trek fandom too, but I don't think you have as much of that because it's just not a franchise that appeals as broadly as these other two.
And it might be partially because of just how much there is.
Yes.
Like at this stage, if like someone's like, oh, I haven't seen or read Harry Potter, okay, you read these 7 books, you watch these 8 movies. Beyond that is like you could take or leave.
Yeah.
With Star Trek, it's like, okay, well, you have to watch how many different series
Right.
to, I mean, I don't know if I would have gone as deep as I did if not for the pandemic.
Right.
That I was like, well, need to watch something a lot. I got a lot of time to sit and watch TV. So that might be part of it. Yeah, I feel like Trek has always had this thought of being like deeply nerdy in a way that Harry Potter has not had the same reputation. There are a lot of people who are into Harry Potter who are like not even otherwise into sci-fi and fantasy. I love both very deeply, but I have definitely found like more people would know Star Wars than Star Trek. Though I've definitely seen there are a few people at MuggleNet who like are also quite into Star Trek, and that's always nice to be like, oh, you like that too?
Yeah.
Great. I guess I would encourage Star Trek fans to give Harry Potter a try if they haven't and like apply some of their thoughts about Star Trek to it and vice versa. Because I always think that when you get into something new with something else that's already a major fandom for you, it's impossible to not make parallels. If you're someone who is so deeply into Star Trek, I imagine you see Star Trek everywhere. And same with if you're into Harry Potter, you see Harry Potter everywhere. So I guess I'd encourage anyone who is casually into both to, I don't know, think about them next to each other or against each other or pushing each other in different ways. Because I think there is a lot to see. And sometimes it's fine to use different and fun to use different parts of your brain with different things that you are into.
I definitely think that when you juxtapose two different stories together, you often see things that you didn't see before in each one of them in ways that are productive. I mean, I did a Star Wars Harry Potter mashup in the other volume. So I was part of the not buttoned up crew.
I did
It's
on
not that they
MuggleNet.
weren't. It's not that they weren't. It was just there were some interesting observable differences.
I
That's
on
right.
MuggleNet sorted all the characters from various Star Trek series into their Hogwarts houses.
Well,
Oh,
we need to link that in the show
that's
notes.
right. Because that's what happens
Definitely.
when I like look at anything. I'm like, which Hogwarts house would they be?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Well, one of the
Like, does
things.
it go with the colors of their sh tunics?
It does not. Except a lot of
Okay.
captains are Gryffindors because, and they're red. And obviously, science makes sense with Ravenclaw, but I think quite a lot does not go with what they're
Like
wearing. Like,
McCoy. McCoy, he can't be a Ravenclaw.
I think we had him as a
McCoy?
Hufflepuff. I think a lot of the
Yeah.
doctors are Hufflepuffs.
Yeah, I think he's definitely a puff.
I do
And
think
see
that, I
that?
think I had Data as a Hufflepuff too, actually.
Data, I can definitely
He
believe
wants to
that.
be human so badly. He's smart because he is programmed to be smart. You know, so in terms
Yes,
of, oh,
right.
people think he's a Ravenclaw because, like, well, he's very intelligent because that's how he was programmed to be. His personality is the desire and curiosity to connect with others and be more human.
His
And I
cat.
think that makes
And
him
I think
Hufflepuff.
Janeway is a Ravenclaw.
Can't remember
She's
what I had her
always,
as. I think I had her as Gryffindor.
she is always sciencing the way out of the situation. She is always like, try this, B'Elanna. And then B'Elanna does it and it's like, why aren't you chief engineer? Oh, because you're busy being captain.
Yeah, I love this. And I think that when you're looking at the fandoms, of course, what is it that connects the fans together? It's the content, but then it's the friendships that people develop as they are talking about these big issues that are raised that are actually really important to our own lives as well. And I think we get a real charge out of that. And I hope that the listeners do too. And so that's one of, to me, that's one of the best things about the fandom is that you can argue about whether Janeway would be a Ravenclaw or a Gryffindor, or
Or Slytherin. Some people might say Slytherin.
Or the, you
I
know.
got into a fight with someone once that Picard is a Ravenclaw. I think Picard's a Ravenclaw. He's a Renaissance man at heart. But a lot of people think he's a Gryffindor. I'm not saying he's not brave,
He's
but
got
I
all that
think,
Shakespeare. I can see
right? He
Ravenclaw for
loves
sure.
archaeology. Like if you just dropped him in the middle of nowhere, like I think Ravenclaw energy. He
I
gives
can
these
totally see
big
that.
speeches and using logic and history and you know, references to literature to make his point.
I'm with you. I'm
Yeah,
with
I
you.
get that. I get
Yeah.
that. I think this brings us to a conclusion that makes some sense for this episode, but I feel like there is a lot of potential to keep this conversation going. So, certainly, listeners, if you have thoughts that, you know, areas of connection that we did not manage to hit upon, then you would like to hear more about, or if you have your own thoughts, we would love to hear from you. And, you know, maybe we'll put together a, you know, a part two of our Star Trek, Harry Potter mashup extravaganza.
Yes.
Well, thank you so much, Lori, for being our special guest on the show today. And we finally got to talk extensively about this connection between Potter and Trek.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm always happy to mash up fandoms I enjoy.
Kapwa.
It's just,
Kapwa! Oh my
it's,
God, we didn't say that the whole time. I was waiting for a live long and prosper.
yeah, I was going to say, damn it, Jim, I'm a Harry Potter podcaster, not a Trekker.
I really appreciate that Laurie knows the difference between a trekker and a trekkie.
My parents have told me this.
Yes, it was trekkie was originally derogatory for Star Trek fans, so that's why
That's not
some of us
cool.
don't call ourselves trekkies.
Well, my parents are like, I don't dress up and I don't go to conventions. They're like, that's, I don't think they think it's derogatory. It's just like not what they do. They're like, that's Trekkie. Trekker is just like, we watch it a lot.
I love it.
Okay.
Yeah.
To each their own. Well, our closing quote today is from Book Five, Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix, as the students are taking their practical astronomy OWL. Although their eyes are supposed to be on the stars, there is trouble happening below them, and Harry is struggling to stay focused. He could feel Professor Marchbanks's eyes on the back of his neck and pressed his eye again to the telescope, staring up at the moon. Though he had marked its position an hour ago. But as Professor Marchbanks moved on, he heard a roar from the distant cabin that echoed through the darkness right to the top of the astronomy tower. Several of the people around Harry ducked out from behind their telescopes and peered instead in the direction of Hagrid's cabin. In both Star Trek and Harry Potter, even when we talk about space, we're really observing the world around us. Look out for your friends and neighbors, dear listeners.
We hope you have enjoyed this episode of Potterversity. Send us your thoughts on the episode or propose ideas for future episodes by writing to potterversitypodcast@gmail.com. If you like the show, consider leaving a review on iTunes and be sure to follow Potterversity on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Potterversity is brought to you by MuggleNet, the number one Wizarding World resource since 1999. Emma Nicholson is technical director, and the show is produced by Laurie Beckhoff. Our theme music is performed by The Town, featuring Sean Elsbernd, Scott Hacker, Travis Princey, Ashley Shepherd, and Emily Strand, and produced by Sean Elsbernd. I'm your announcer, Dr. Sarah Brown.
Until next time. Live long and prosper.